We'd like to introduce our first speaker. This young lady, her name is Yolanda, and she will be speaking on step two, and she's from an area called Dallas. Can y'all help me welcome Yolanda?
Which mic? Either mic? Both mics? This one? Okay. Oh. Hi, everybody. My name's Yolanda R. I'm an addict.
Hey, Yolanda R.
I'm glad this is a fairly empty room because I was really nervous about coming up here and doing this. So I think if this place was packed to the gills, I'd probably be sweating and stuttering right now. But, I've been spared, which is nice. So I'm from the Dulles Corridor. I have a sponsor. I've always heard people qualify themselves when they get up here and do this thing. So, I probably should too. My sponsor has a sponsor. I work the steps to the best of my ability. I'm sure I don't do it perfect. And you can corroborate that with my sponsor. She'll be the first to tell you that usually what ends up happening is that I end up working the steps when my ass is on fire. So I'll wait as long as I possibly can and be in as much pain as I can handle until I scurry back to where it is that I probably should have been in the first place, and following the path that has been set out before me in this program. So I guess I'm talking tonight about step two. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Before we begin, I should probably explain that I'm an atheist. And before all the God-fearing folks start walking out of the room, let me just say a few things. First, I have no interest in challenging your beliefs. And second, before you decide you have nothing to learn from what I have to say, I should probably tell you about my spirituality. So, first of all, I can't get away with saying that only God can judge me. I have to stand before the law and my peers based on the merit of my behavior. So that excuse does not exist for me. And I don't get to say that my mistakes are God's will. I don't know God's will. I don't know if there's a God. It's probably more accurate to say that I'm an agnostic as opposed to an atheist because I'm open to the question, I can't say that I'm 100% sure that I don't believe. But, I'm pretty sure for myself. And that's enough, So I don't know God's will. But if you truly believe that God works in mysterious ways and that's part of your spiritual program, then when it comes down to it, neither do you. So we have something in common. As a matter of fact, according to to step two in the basic text, we all have one thing in common. We seek our destruction a bag at a time, a few pills at a time, or a bottle at a time until we die. And I know that's what I did. And that's how I got here. And that's how my journey fits into step two, as unorthodox as that may be. Because I got here the same way that you did, one drug at a time. And I had to find my own spiritual awakening in here, just like everybody else. I hear people toss around Psalm 139 a lot. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. And honestly, that's how I felt about drugs. Drugs were my higher power. It was what I understood to control my life, what I understood to be the apex of my existence. And I like Psalms, by the way, and Songs of Solomon. I actually have a religious background. I was raised in a very religious household. Well, I wouldn't say very religious. My grandmother was a devout Christian, and she shared that devotion with me. Plus, I have about 12 years of parochial schooling. So I've actually done a lot of Bible study in my life. And I mean, one of the first memories that I have is I was one of those kids who always had to have, I like to build stuff. So, I'd be in the backyard or something with a hammer in my hand. We lived in a real working class neighborhood. My dad was in law school. I'm half Hispanic, so our neighborhood was real mixed, and that kind of fit into the fabric, the comfort zone of my family. So I was always in the backyard with like a hammer trying to build something. I was putting these pieces of wood together, and my dad is talking to the neighbor, kind of proud about what it is that I'm doing, until he asked me what it was that I was building. And I told him that I was making a cross for Jesus, because I was in kindergarten and everybody had told me that Jesus was coming. So I figured he needed to know where we lived, you know. So I was making the natural symbol, like he needed to find everybody, right? So like, here's our house, you know. And the look on my dad's face was priceless. I can't even begin to explain how it was that he managed to finish that conversation with our neighbor. But, I had God in my life, and I didn't really start questioning what it was that I believed until probably that same year. I was in kindergarten. I was home. I remember it very vividly. Like what the carpet felt like underneath my hands. I was watching Tom and Jerry on the television. My mother was in the kitchen washing the dishes, and she went upstairs to check on the baby. And the next thing I hear is just this incredible, like, primal screaming coming from upstairs. And then my memory goes dark, and the next thing I remember is crying in my grandmother's lap, and the firemen are in my house, and they're taking my little brother away. He's wrapped in a white blanket, and they're taking him out the front door. And that was the last time that I saw my little brother again. My brother died a crib death, and I stayed an only child for a while. So for me, my thought was, and I guess it's natural for a kid this age to think that, was, how is it my fault? Because I assumed, especially I think maybe because of my religious training, possibly played a role in this as well, did my jealousy somehow make me an accomplice in the act of murdering my brother? Because I had been jealous, you know? I had been robbed of being the only child. And there were times when I didn't like that. And so when he died, there was a part of me that felt a lot of guilt and shame, because I believed that God had heard some private prayer I had made in the back of my mind and had decided that he was going to answer it, and that I was now paying the consequences, and my family was paying the consequences of my selfishness. That's a big burden when you're four. And it didn't help that my family was falling apart. Excuse me. Speaking of which, I'm pregnant. Actually, stair climbing is, you know, I climbed the stairs to get up here, and now I'm fighting for breath a little bit. But when I was a kid, and I just remember, it's still uncomfortable to talk about how incredibly unstable my house became in that time. My dad is not real good at handling his emotions, so there was a lot of screaming in my house. This is back in the day when vacuum cleaners were much bigger appliances than they are now, much heavier appliances. And I just remember him picking up this vacuum cleaner and swinging it like a mallet over his head into the floor, and just repeatedly just slamming this thing into the floor, and like bolts and screws popping off of it as pieces just shattered off this thing. And my mother's response to the death of my brother was to become completely depressed. So she lost interest in me, and I think maybe for a while she might have lost interest in living. It's hard to be a kid and to understand why it is that your mother really doesn't want too much of a part of you, you know? Why when you climb in bed with her, mostly what she wants is to be left alone. And, you know, all I could think to do was to try and write my parents notes. I would write a note to my mother saying, I'm sorry, love Dad, in my childish handwriting, and then leave it for, you know, and I would do this with both of them. So it took my parents probably, well, anyway, the next child, the next youngest child for me is my brother Chris, who's actually 7 years younger than me. So it took them a while to kind of, like, I think figure out that they wanted to do this, you know, that they wanted to give it another shot as a family. I don't know. But when my brother Chris got married in September, my dad sent an email to the family talking about how, like, my brother was my mother's salvation. And it brought me right back to those feelings that I had as a kid of, why not me? Why couldn't it have been me? You still had a child left. Like, why wasn't I the one that you could center your world around? But it just wasn't the case, you know? I spent a lot of time with my grandparents. I spent a lot of time in summer school, you know, camping, that kind of stuff, all of which was good for me, all of which developed me as a person. And I'm thankful for my parents that they were able to do those things, especially since it was my mother who was really supporting the family while my dad went to law school. But all of those feelings that I had were setting me up for a lot of stuff to happen to me later, I think. Because feeling different and set apart was the hallmark of my childhood. I was the little buck-toothed fat girl who always, like, had her hand raised in class because I knew the answer, you know. And I sucked at sports, and none of that went over in my school. And especially I went to a predominantly, my parents wanted to keep me out of public school. It's part of the reason why I ended up in parochial schools, because city schools were just, you know, not where my parents wanted to put me. So I was in a predominantly white classroom. And being half Hispanic with the kind of exotic name that I have, was just another way for me to be different than everybody else. So I had a lot of problems transitioning into middle school. I couldn't face my problems at home, and I was basically being tortured at school. And there are some things that happened to me during that time that I haven't discussed with anyone outside of a fifth step. So my response essentially was to become a delinquent. I started working at the age of 12. My mother basically told me that I was going to get a say in the house when I started paying rent. And I went to the phone book, and I started looking up farms around the area. And I called every single one until one of them was willing to take me on as a stable hand. And then I walk right back into the living room and said, I have a job. I start this weekend. So that's the kind of kid that I was. I would say about 6 months later, I was smoking. And by the time I was 14, I was doing drugs pretty actively, and nobody could tell me anything. By high school, I was caring for my two younger brothers, who are 7 and 9 years younger than me. And even though my grandparents were in the house as kind of surrogate babysitters, my grandparents were in their 80s. So really, I was taking care of two kids and two seniors as a teenager, and I was working on the weekends and sometimes at night. So there was nothing that anybody could say to me about my behavior or the way that I wanted to live my life. And, you know, I didn't know any other way but my way, and I was just fine with that. But even through all that, I still had God. My parents decided that it was wise to keep me in Catholic school as long as humanly possible, because unleashing me on a public school environment, I think they thought would be a travesty for everybody. So they kept me in parochial school, and I can't say that that was a bad thing. I enjoyed Bible study as a teenager. I wasn't always happy with the answers that were being provided to me, but it didn't, you know, shake my faith that there was something. I just accepted that what other people took as the word of God was a matter of human opinion. Later in college, I expanded my spiritual view. I read a lot of texts from various world religions. I've read a lot of religious texts. I've read the Quran. I've read the Buddhist sutras. just a lot of stuff. And all of that added to my spiritual life. None of it really kind of shook my idea that I was part of some conscious thing that was bigger than me. You know, and even in the midst of the worst of my using, I didn't resent God. And I didn't have any feeling of turning away from God. I saw God as an ally in my struggles. And the closer that I got to the end, that feeling kind of bolstered me up a little bit. I was having a lot of delusions and hallucinations toward the end. It was the late stage processes, right? Just like spiders coming out of the walls, you know. I mean, just crazy, crazy. I was crazy. Just deeply toxic. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know if I thought it was a test or what, or if any of it even still made sense at that point, but I don't think it was really until I got here that my faith really started to come into question. It's one thing to say foxhole prayers when you're using. It's another thing to try to live a life of faith when you're in here and to submit to the program. Because I wasn't used to submission. Submission, you know, meant somebody was going to pray on me. So I had a real hard time with that when I got here. Step two says the first thing we do in this program is stop using. At this point, we begin to feel the pain of living without drugs or anything to replace them. This pain forces us to seek a power greater than ourselves that can relieve our obsession to use. And that was me. You know, and I wrestled constantly with step two. You know, and later trying to turn my will and my life over to the care of God in step three. It was just, I had a real hard time trying to reconcile who I thought God was with what people thought I should believe God to be. And I think I still do to a certain degree. But time has taught me a few things. I think after 10 years, it's just gotten easier to do this. I don't know. It was like I knew too much. So I'm not sure. Sometimes I wrote notes for tonight, right? And now that I'm looking at them, I'm thinking to myself, what do I really think? I've been trying to wrestle with that for the past couple of days. What do I really think about step two? You know, step two was a really important part of my recovery, but not in the way that it is for most people. It wasn't like some shining light, you know, that was like coming to save me from my own delusions. It was like the realization that I came to was really harsh. I hadn't lived in reality in a long time. So it was like being thrown into a cold bath. And that was really, really devastating for me to come to a place where I was really searching for faith and then to not be able to find it. It was Good Friday. I think I had like 2 years clean. And I was having a really rough time. I've been struggling for a long time. My first sponsor was actually a special education teacher, and she fired me because I was too special ed for her, I guess. I don't know. Like, I could not conform to, you know, I could not conform. I couldn't show up on time. I wasn't working the steps the way that she thought that she should. And then she would be like, well, let's pray together. And I'd be like, oh, my God, you know, I can't do this. And eventually she was the one who kind of called it a day. But so that was probably for the best because my third sponsor actually ordered me into therapy. And it took me a long time to kind of stop being as toxic as I was and to just allow the crazy to leave my system. Once I got to that point, things started to change. But it was a rough, rough process because all of the foundation that I had to be stripped away before a new one could be built. It's a common cliche around here, but in my case, it was very true. And I was having, so back to Good Friday, I was having a real rough time with all sorts of stuff. you know, my home situation, my boyfriend, my job, my recovery, my fears and insecurities and all that stuff. And I remember crying and stumbling my way into a church, not realizing that it was Good Friday and that there was Mass going on. So I blow through the church doors in the back in this and scare this congregation who's in the middle of Mass. And I tried to compose myself enough to sit in the back seat somewhere. And they were asking for people to leave letters. So I wrote myself a little note, and as I came up to the front of the church and I put my note on the cross, it was in that moment that I knew that I didn't believe. And there was no way not to get around it. It was obvious to me that I did not believe in the religion of my childhood, and that if I was going to stay in recovery and stay clean, I was not allowed to lie to myself. So it was pretty devastating. But I don't know. Step two says our understanding of a higher power is up to us. No one is going to decide for us. We can call it the group, the program, or we can call it God. The only suggested guidelines are that this power be loving, caring, and greater than ourselves. We don't have to be religious to accept this idea. The point is that we open our minds to believe. We may have difficulty with this, but by keeping an open mind, sooner or later, we find the help that we need. If not for that quote, where would I be? Because don't I deserve recovery too, even as an agnostic? Don't I deserve as much mercy as anybody else? You know, people quote John 3:16 to me as if the scales are going to fall from my eyes like Saul on the road to Damascus. And it doesn't work that way. You know, as an agnostic, as someone who's very nearly atheist, all I ask is that if I can accept your prayers, then you should be able to accept my doubt, because it's the real deal. And it's clear to me that the program can accept this of both. But, which brings me to my final thoughts. So what about the program? It's a spiritual program, right? And it is. You know? But in the end, part of my contract with whatever will the universe has is that I have to accept that this program is written and administered by people. It's not a gospel. And if it was, I'd probably be more critical of it than I am. I follow it because it works, and that's miracle enough for me. When I deviate from the path, you know, my own common sense and belief in the principles of the program caused me to rediscover it and then to try it your way. So really, it's the love of my fellow addicts that keeps me coming back, and the knowledge and the fear that there's nothing else out there for me. You know, the only thing that waits for me out there is jails, institutions, and death. You know, and if not for you guys, I wouldn't have a place to go. So I try to keep it very clear that I am here for me, but it's also my job to keep the door open, just like it's your job to keep the door open. So next time somebody comes in judging their faith, cut them a break. Give them a chance to find what they need for themselves and let them live. So thanks for letting me share.
We'd like to thank our speaker. And at this time, I'd like to introduce our second speaker. His name is Ryan D. from Battlefield, and he's going to be sharing on to... He's going to be sharing on to District 2.
My name's Ryan. I'm an addict. I was getting nervous that group over there wouldn't show up. I'd like to thank you all for coming. I'd like to thank the, programming subcommittee for asking me to share. I got to tell you, I'm incredibly nervous, right? I could share no problem in a meeting this size if we were all sitting in a circle, but you put this magic podium up here, and it separates me from you, and that, you know, it does something. I don't know what. So I'll do the best I can, right? So they asked me to talk about tradition two, and I'm not going to read a bunch of stuff out of the literature. If you haven't read about tradition two in our literature, you should. They can say it much better than I can. What I'd like to do is share with you my experience with tradition two, right? And to do that, I'm not going to tell my story, but I'll give you a little insight into some stuff I, before I started using, right, I was not a popular child. I had a twin brother. We were in the same grade, same school. He was the athletic, popular one. He had all the friends, and consequently, I was kind of the outcast, whatever you will. And so early on, like I said, well before I ever started using, I discovered that my defense mechanism for that was that I find whatever it is that you believe in, I find why I don't believe in that, and I reject you before you can reject me, right? Because if I try to fit in with you, it won't work, and you'll see through that, and that causes me pain. But if I can pick out any little thing about you that I can disagree with, then I cannot care about you, and I don't care if you like me or not, right? Some of you might be able to relate to that. And that was what, you know, grade school, middle school, high school was like for me. That went away when I started using, right? I found a better solution in using, because if you had drugs, then we can be friends, right? And if I had drugs, then you would be my friend. Fantastic. But the reason that I bring that up is because when I got here, you know, I'd been in jail for like a month, so I didn't come in with a day or two clean. So I kind of, and I was still in a bit of a haze, but I'd fallen back on all of those old defense mechanisms that I'd learned before I started using, because the ones that I got when I was using, I couldn't use those anymore. The drugs were gone, like those, you know. And so all I knew was that when I came in here, I was going to have to find all the reasons that I could disagree with you so that I, you know, wouldn't have to get to know you, because you were going to reject me anyway, right? And so the reason that I love the traditions so much is because the traditions took away all those reasons that I could find to not like you. I got in here, and the only thing you told me was that you guys were going to show me how to live without getting high. Right? You didn't try to push anything on me. You didn't try to push, you know, a certain idea of God on me. You didn't try to push God on me at all, thank God. Right? Because I didn't come in brimming with spirituality and having some great belief. Although I was, I guess, agnostic atheist too. And looking back, I'm really grateful, because so many people I know were pissed at God when they got here. And I didn't have to go through that. But, you know, so I got here, and, you know, I couldn't find all those things that were easy for me to pick out in the outside world to disagree with you about, because all we did was recover, right? And I consider myself lucky. My first sponsor was a bit of a tradition Nazi, right? Which I love, right? So consequently, what we did was we read the traditions, and then we sat around and we talked about how we worked them in our lives, right? And then he was also a service junkie, so then after we talked about him, we went and we tried to apply him in service. For the first 3 years that I was around here, I didn't know any of Robert's Rules of Order. The area that I came from used consensus-based decision-making, which, if you've never experienced, is basically you sit in a room and you argue until everyone says, okay, we're done arguing, let's just do it. It's like kind of my idea of it. It's a little more complicated than that. I think they talk about it in our Guide to Local Service. But what it taught me was that we all have a say in what goes on here, right? So the second tradition tells me that in Narcotics Anonymous, God's in charge, right? And there may be people that we elect to kind of run things, because honestly, things like conventions need to be run. but it's our higher power, my higher power, your higher power. It can be completely different higher powers, but we come together and that's who's in charge, right? So if you have one day clean, your higher power is just as important as my higher power, is just as important as the higher power of the guy with 30 years clean. And so I have a responsibility as a member of Narcotics Anonymous to speak up. And when I say speak up, I don't mean demand. And I don't have the right to, you know, insist that we do things my way. But I have a responsibility to let you know what my higher power is telling me in a situation, right? And I kind of think of the second tradition as the way I apply the third and the 11th steps in the rooms, right? I make that decision in my life to seek out and try to follow my higher power's will and to look for what he wants me to be doing. All the second tradition does is say, do that in here, right? It's so easy for me to come in here and people say, we'd like you to, you know, be a trusted servant, and for me to hear, all right, I'm in charge. And when I'm out there and I say to myself, all right, I'm in charge, the alarm bells go off in my head, right? And I know, oh, we got problems now, because we know what happens when I'm in charge. And I don't know why I think I can not be in charge out there, but come in here and run things, right? Early on it was made clear to me that, everyone has and I say obligation because, everyone has an obligation to let their home group, their area service committee, the regional service committee, whatever service they're doing, know what their higher power is telling them. And that was, it was demonstrated to me, my old home group. I don't know if you guys do it. A lot of home groups do it. If you've heard, you know, the everyone with a year or more clean time, please raise your hands so you can see that, you know, whatever. And we'd, after like a two-hour business meeting one night, we came to the conclusion that we didn't want to do that anymore, that we felt it excluded people with less than a year clean time. And it was probably because there were a lot of people with less than a year clean time. And they, I don't know. And there was a newcomer there. It was her first day clean, her first meeting ever. And we'd somehow conned her into sticking around for the business meeting. And so we're all sitting around discussing what is it that we want to say in place of that. And she said, well, I'm new here and I don't really know what this is all about. But why don't you say, anyone who feels the program's working in their life, would you please raise your hand? And it was like, oh, right. And this came from someone with one day clean who was at their first meeting ever, right? And if that business meeting had been run by people who were in charge and shooting people down, we probably never would have heard that. And she never would have felt comfortable sharing what I believe was her higher power speaking through her to us, right? It's hard. It's hard when you're in a room full of 30 GSRs. And they, you know, all have different ideas. I don't do well in those situations, right? The yelling comes out. This isn't about doing it right all the time. It's about trying to do it right, right? It's about trying to work that third and that 11th step and to do what my higher power is telling me to do. And I guess, you know, and this is where, so that's kind of, you know, my understanding of the second tradition within our service structure. But the things about the traditions that was taught to me was that I can apply them to my life outside as well. So I talked about how in high school my defense mechanism was to find and find those reasons that I could be separate from you and I could disagree with you. The other fantastic defense mechanism that I developed was that I had to be smarter than you, right? I don't know if I actually was. I just didn't have any friends, so I had a lot of time to study. So I generally knew I was good in school, right? I had the answers, and I used that as a weapon. And so in any given situation, I could tell you exactly why you were wrong, right? I could, and I knew it. I could tell you why you were wrong. I could tell you what the real answer was, and I could make you, or hell, I could, in my eyes, make you less than me, right? When in fact, the whole time I was just feeling less than everyone. But the beauty of the second tradition for me is that it teaches me that pretty much no matter what the situation, I could be wrong, right? Which was not something I could admit when I got here. Not only could I be wrong, but you could be right, right? You know, if we're being led by God, and I'm not talking about, you know, finite things like, you know, how many pennies in a dollar. I'm talking about situations that arise that I can feel, or I can think deep down, oh, I have to be right here, right? If our higher powers come together and decide that I'm wrong, well, then I'm wrong. And it's amazing to me. It's amazing to me how often I can know that I'm right and I'm not. And this is a stupid story, but I'll tell it. And it's, I'm not sure if you guys all know who Alanis Morissette is, singer, person. I have a distinct memory from when I was using. I was sitting in a living room with my friends, Jeannie and Craig. I was on the frickin' sofa thing. They were in chairs, and they said to me, Alanis Morissette was in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. They said this to me, and I said, no, that's, like, not possible. You have to be wrong. And I distinctly remember putting in the VHS tape, because it was no DVDs yet, and rolling to the credits and seeing her frickin' name, right? Okay. So, it, like, that memory is, and I still remember it. Well, like, 3 years ago, we're at a NA person's birthday party, and I don't remember what we're talking about, and I make the statement, you know, Alanis Morissette was in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And this girl goes, no, she wasn't. She's not even old enough, right? And I'm like, no, you have to be wrong. I have the memory. It's clear as day. You have to be wrong. And she pulled it up on her phone, and sure, shit. Nope, she wasn't. I have no idea where that memory came from, right? I do not often live in reality. It's better now, right? But I lived in that haze of maybe, you know, I don't have real good memories of the last 5 years of my using, you know, probably because days are supposed to be 24 hours and I made days many more hours than that. So I apparently have lots and lots of memories that aren't real. And when I get so caught up in that old defense mechanism, if I have to be right and try to rely on the brain that I guess before I started using worked right, but no longer seems to function like that, I just make a complete ass out of myself, right? And probably the only thing that I hate worse than feeling less than you is demonstrating that I'm less than you by making an ass out of myself. So I, you know, I try not to do that these days. And the second tradition, when I can remember that in any given situation, no matter how right I think I am, I could still be wrong, and that you might be right. That keeps me from those moments most of the time, though I still have quite a few of them. So, you know, I don't think I'm going to go for my whole 25 minutes. I don't know how far I am, but I would encourage anyone here who wants to learn more about the traditions to go to their sponsor and ask, start a tradition meeting, right? I learned so much. My home group, we did the steps and traditions, right? You read a step, talk about it. We did 12 weeks, and you switch. And when you do that every week, twice a week, whatever your home group meets, you get to hear a lot of people's experience with the traditions. And when I can hear that, it gives me an idea of how to start applying them. Right, because nothing irks me worse than people who can quote the entire book to you and they've never tried to apply anything at all in their life. They have no experience with it, but they'll tell you how to do it. And for me, anyway, the only way that I can ever apply something to my life is to just go out there and practice it and screw it up and do it wrong and ask for help and say, how do I do this right? If you're here listening to someone talk about traditions, you probably know how important they are. So reach out. Reach out to the people that have the decades clean, that have been doing service since, the dawn of time. And ask them, what is your experience with this tradition? And then ask them to teach you, right? Show me how you do this. That's what I do. Show me how you do this. And it amazes me that there are people in my area that come up to me and ask me now, how do you apply this? And I get to share that. I didn't think there would ever be a time in my life where I would have anything to offer to anyone, right? And I definitely didn't think it would be on the traditions. This program never ceases to amaze me, right? This program never stops giving me experiences, giving me opportunities that not only did I never think I would have, but I never even dreamed I would want. Right? I never knew that I would want to be in Ocean's. Well, I'd want to be in Ocean's. I never knew I'd want to be in a convention center full of drug addicts, talking about how do I bring God into service, it's an amazing experience. There are people here that I would never get the opportunity to meet were they not at this convention. So I hope everyone has a fantastic weekend. Thanks for letting me talk at you for a while, and I hope you got something out of that. So.
Thank you. All right, let's thank our speaker names by the name of Ryan D. Got about 15 minutes left.